We're back, joined now by election expert Craig Smith. Craig is the director of the Center for First Amendment Studies at Long Beach State. He's also a professor of communication studies, former presidential speechwriter for President Ford and consultant to President Bush Sr., author of 10 books and hundreds of articles. Craig, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
Great to be back.
We're going to talk about both federal and then the next segment we'll talk about state politics. But where do you see us federally as far as the political dynamics going?
Well, it was a very interesting election. I mean, it was close to a mandate for the president. He won by 3 million votes, which surprised a lot of people that the margin was that large. He is taking what he calls that political capital, and he's going to use it to advance his agenda, which includes Social Security reform, where you'd be able to take some of your money and develop your own 401k kind of operation. He's going to push his conservative judges forward. And I think that's a more nuanced question than people think. There are two kinds of conservative judges. There are conservative activists, which I think violate the spirit of the founders. The founders believed in a strict reading of the Constitution, and that's where I think true conservatives come down. But ever since the Bork nomination, we've fought over ideology on these judges. I think that's unfortunate. I think if they're competent, they should be appointed. And so now we're going to see the Republicans try to change the rules on
get less than two-thirds.
Well, it's not. They never had to have two-thirds. They only had to have a majority. But they had to get by the filibuster,
which requires two-thirds.
It used to require two-thirds. It now requires 60%. And so they're going to say, for judges only, for judicial appointments only, read the Constitution. It takes a majority in the Senate, so let's go to an up or down vote on them. And that will help them pass a number of the more conservative.
What's your view, judges? Craig, of the appropriate role of the opposition or the Senate in its advising and consenting? If I'm a Democratic senator and I don't believe in the judicial philosophy of candidate A for the Supreme Court, am I entitled to vote against him?
You're entitled to do that. You're entitled to vote against him or her. But remember that until the Bork nomination, if someone was competent, they generally went along.
Gave him a pass.
You had to show financial indiscretion, criminal indiscretion. In the case of Carswell, he'd made racial remarks in 1948. So there was something to get them on. When Bork came along, he was the first one. He had no financial problems, no racial problems. He just happened to believe in the doctrine of a strict reading of the Constitution. That upset some abortion rights people who read that to mean he would vote against a woman's right to have an abortion, and that brought a landslide of lobbying down on him. And since that time...
Would that be overturning Roe v. Wade type of
yes, thing? Yes. I think he was heading in that direction. But he was the first nomination where a president went on television and said, save my nomination and appeal to the public. And ever since then, with every Supreme Court nomination, every president's gone on television.
And this president will too.
Yes.
And he's getting some support groups to weigh in on this, I understand.
Well, he has brought on former Governor Englander of Michigan, who was a friend of his, to head a group that will lobby in favor of his judicial nominees.
What about the war effort? I know it's somewhat outside your bailiwick, but and our viewers have different opinions on the wisdom of going in and certainly some of the challenges that now that we're there, but the president, as commander-in-chief, has a responsibility to communicate to the country his vision and to galvanize the country behind his program. Is he doing that?
I think he is, but I think he could have, in the campaign, done a better job. There was a time during the campaign when everybody shifted their attention to weapons of mass destruction. That was only one of the reasons we went in. Remember, Saddam Hussein was in violation of UN Resolution 1441. He wouldn't allow inspectors in. When he allowed them in, he wouldn't cooperate. He had exercised genocide on the Kurds, genocides against Iran.
Aided and abetted terrorism in Palestine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Furthermore, we were told by Hosni Mubarak that he had weapons of mass destruction. We were told by King Hussein of Jordan that he had weapons of mass destruction. I think we did the responsible thing, but I don't think that the president presented all those arguments as clearly as he could over and over again so the public understood that it wasn't only weapons of mass destruction that we were after.
Well, but he did not do that in the build-up to the invasion, too. He kind of right. hung his hat on the MWD.
Well, you and I remember Colin Powell's speech at the UN,
yep.
And it did that, too. It had the other stuff, but then it went there, and I think that was a mistake.
Before we went on here, you had an interesting theory on Zeitgeist.
Uh-huh.
Would you just share that, those views?
Well, a Zeitgeist is like a spirit that you have of someone that you build your persona around. And I've noticed with contemporary presidents that they all have a favorite president before them that they will refer to and act like. For example, Ronald Reagan, his favorite was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Even the talk about getting Reagan a third and fourth term came out of that Roosevelt spirit that he had.
These things cross party lines quite a bit.
Yeah, Bill Clinton was in party lines because I think Bill Clinton's zeitgeist was John Kennedy.
Sure.
But this president, for me, his zeitgeist is Harry Truman.
George Bush, George W., his zeitgeist is Harry, kind of the tough man in the street kind of guy.
Decisive. You know where I stand. You may not like it, but you know where I stand. He said that over and over again through the campaign.
Yeah.
And people voted for it.
What do you think of him as a communicator? I mean, a lot of people are critical of his syntax and the fact that he is not as articulate as some of the other presidents. Seems to me, though, that he communicates on a very visceral level with the American public.
Yeah. I think one thing that people like about him is that he's so human. I mean, he has a very consistent persona. He's this guy out of Texas. He doesn't pronounce every word right. But oftentimes when a speaker makes a mistake and does little stumbles, we think they're more sincere. We think they're more authentic than the smooth salesman type.
Yes, yes. And you made a contrast between him and his father.
Yes.
Bush Sr.
Well, I think that the father was more the New England gentleman. He was a true Yalie, he was very thoughtful, but I don't think, and I worked closely with him, and I loved him to death, but I don't think he worked out a consistent persona for himself. Sometimes he was this kinder, gentler man who understood that issues were complicated, and at other times he was this tough guy that dropped into this kind of Clint Eastwood language.
Read my lips,
yeah. No new taxes.
Yeah.
And those were inconsistent, and I think if he had a consistent persona, he would have done better in terms of his re-election campaign in 92.
And George W., in your view, has this consistent persona. You may like it or not like it, but that's what it is.
Right.
Yeah. Fascinating. Okay, well, we continue this discussion, but first we're going to take a pause for these messages. We're back continuing this fascinating conversation with Craig Smith, former presidential speechwriter and director of the Center for First Amendment Studies at CSULB. Let's turn now, Craig, to the state level and the Terminator. How's he doing?
Well, I think he's doing very well, better than a lot of people expected. He's got great advisors. He's kind of holding to the middle road. He's being less ideological. He revives my proud moderate Republicanism. And so I think he's doing fine.
Okay, in his State of the State address recently, he ticked off four major areas that needed reform: budget caps, redistricting, pension reform, and merit pay for teachers, and suggested that if the legislature did not deliver legislation on those areas by next May, he's going to get it on the ballot next November. Is that a workable threat?
I think it is a workable threat. I think he has a lot of political capital. He's been successful on some ballot propositions. People want this to work. They want a bipartisan approach to the issues. They're tired of the gridlock. And he hits some major stuff that's really important.
What do you think is most important?
I think what's most important for this state is redistricting.
Yeah, and we've talked about that on here before.
We've talked about that before. But when you have 150 seats up for election in California and not a single one changes hands, you got a problem. I mean, I like the governor's proposal that this be turned over to a judicial panel and that they fairly redistrict the state. They did it in Iowa, and it worked out very well. They've done it in other states. I think we should try it here.
And I've said this publicly on this program. I think that legislators should not select their voters through this inside the Beltway redistricting, but voters should select their legislators. And it's outrageous to have every district safe.
No question about it. It just locks everything in, and we get nowhere every year.
And as we both know, that results in the real race being in the primary, and the most liberal Democrat normally wins the primary, and the most conservative Republican wins the Republican primary. So we have gridlock at the legislative level.
Right. I also think we should consider going to a unicameral House, the same way Nebraska does. Why do we have a Senate that's based on population and a House that's based on population. Those are duplicative. They jam one another up. Just have one House, and it would make the system much more efficient.
Okay, I'll have to think about that. What else is important besides redistricting?
Well, the education budget's important because, as you know, we had a proposition in California that locked in 40% of the budget for K through 14.
Is that Prop 98?
Prop 98, old Prop 98, and it locked it in K through 14. That excludes the California State University system, which has 400,000 students, the largest university in the world. It excludes the University of California. So we have to go begging to Sacramento.
And they automatically get 40%
of the budget. They automatically get their
money. And as the budget income grows, their 40% grows.
That's correct. Now, the budget analyst, the legislative budget analyst, a Democrat, says that you could cut that budget, $2.8 billion, the projected budget, $2.8 billion, and it would still grow. Schwarzenegger said, okay, I won't cut it to 2.8. That's the liberal figure. I'll only cut it $2.2 billion. I think that was awfully good of him. And then take that
so
money.
So he wants to move away from Prop 98, where 40% automatic, and he's going to propose legislation to do that, or if not, go to the people.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. What about pension reform? And we've all read about runaway pension costs.
Well, the one of the things that happened in the university system, at least, and I think a little bit also in K through 12, was because we were paying so low, we provided better offline benefits, better health care, better retirement benefits. That was the only way we could attract people into the state where prices are so high. The governor now sees some of that spiraling away and wants to go more to a 401k kind of pension system for professors and others entering the
defined
system.
Defined contribution.
Defined contribution.
Defined benefit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we may have to do that given an $8 billion budget that we deficit that we have to clear up somehow.
And finally, merit pay. We're both in education. We may have different views on this, but this is merit pay for K-12 initially.
Right. I'm very much in favor of merit pay. I think that, first of all, I think that tenure is granted too early in the K-12 system. You can get tenure in 3 years. You can sit back at that point, and you don't have to perform, and there's nothing they can do to you. If you had merit pay, you'd have some kind of carrot out there that got people coming back.
But then you get to the classic question of how do you measure merit?
It's a tough thing to do, and I think it should be at a high level where people can clearly define objective standards by which merit would be measured.
What about teachers that go into tough schools and it's a lot of work and maybe just a little bit of results, but they're in there plugging away every day, and yet they're not measured, you don't see it on the tests. And we've read some well-publicized abuses of teachers giving answers to students where salaries are based on performance on the test.
Well, first of all, wherever you are, if teaching improves, the test should improve. If you're in a tough school, there it's easier to do improvement there than at higher level schools.
The merit would be based on rate of improvement, not objective levels of performance.
That would be one measure.
Okay.
But
it
could also be one of the measures taken into account would be the number of students you had in the classroom.
Okay.
You know, if you have to teach a high number of students, you should be given a break.
Okay, we have 30 seconds left, Craig. Your vision for the future of California?
Redistricted and becoming a much tighter legislative situation that will force more cooperation with the governor, that will get us budgets that we can live with in the future.
And we are a third world state, and it's working. Multiculturalism at work and play.
The most diverse place in America is right here in Long Beach.
We love it.
Yep, absolutely.
Thanks for joining us. Be with us next week for the next edition of Straight Talk. Good night, everyone.
Straight Talk has been brought to you by Southern California Edison and other fine sponsors. Support the quality sponsors who support Straight Talk.